Good to see everybody. We were just talking about the business meeting. Now, I've seen an increase in our Sunday evening attendance, and deeply and truly appreciate that. Most encouraging. Start of a new year, and hopefully seeing some of those New Year's resolutions taking place there, taking effect, being lived out, and as we all just simply try to do the best we can. You never know, what the future holds. You have no idea if you'll live even, the rest of this upcoming week. And so each time that we come together, maybe the last time that we'll see any one individual, some great catastrophe could sweep the whole valley away. And so always want to take every occasion that we can to just be with the Lord's people. Can't wait to spend eternity with y'all. Because you're fun enough right down here on planet Earth. We are, of course, studying the life of Joseph somewhat fitfully. I was away, of course, for a couple of weeks with the holidays and a meeting that I held. I will not be preaching next Sunday night, as there'll be an elder's presentation that night. The following Sunday, I will be preaching all day Sunday, the 27th, in Salem, where Jack Hafer is. So we'll have, a two-week hiatus here coming up as well. But tonight, we're going to be looking at a profoundly important aspect that is of our lives that is particularly well exemplified in the life of Joseph. And that's this topic right here. Bitterness is a word that you don't find really an enormous number of times in Scripture as it would apply to our own character, to our own personalities. But it is a word that occurs, I think, a total of 84 times in Scripture. It refers, of course, to the bitterness of the waters at Meribah. It refers to bitter herbs. A man's life, because of physical infirmity, might be bitter. There's a lot of uses of bitterness that we'll not be considering here this evening. Furthermore, we are not going to be looking at these 23 verses in the Old Testament, or 7 in the New, that appear to deal very directly with our own attitude. We have a choice each and every day. You are going to be confronted with things you do not like. I do not like getting out of bed in the morning, but I got to do that. You do too. Pretty well for most of us, every single day, unless we're headed off to Disneyland, starts with reluctance. Already, we have an opportunity for an improper spirit, at least not a lively, energetic, joyful one. There's a temptation that's laid at our feet before we even get our feet out of bed and onto the floor. So tonight we're going to look at only a few, but I think particularly informative verses that have to do with our own temptation to harden our hearts, to carry grudges, to be, just generally sort of a dispiriting spirit for others. And so I wanted especially for us to focus on the greater context of Hebrews 2. So I really appreciate the reading this evening. Nolan did a fine job. Or Frank it was. I forget now who did it. who did the scripture reading. But we looked at earlier verses here. In the context we saw at the reading. But look at just these last two. In Hebrews 2 verses 14 and 15. Pursue peace with everybody. It is our goal in life to be comfortable, relaxed, completely tranquil in our minds and hearts with everybody that we meet. There ought not to be in the course of our day, once we put those feet down on the floor, anybody that we come across, come into contact with, that should make us feel uncomfortable, unhappy. As far as is within us, we want to pursue a peaceful relationship with absolutely everybody. And we want to pursue the sanctification without which no one will see the Lord. So right there, he's saying, you're different, you're set apart, you're sanctified, you're to be that kind of an individual. You need to pursue that. It's not a thing that you just have by nature. And so you're working on these two tasks, peace with everybody, and that still yet is not a peace that sacrifices truth.
It's not a peace that sacrifices virtue. It's not peace at all costs.
Yeah, I'm never going to forget it. I think I probably did, told you about this three times already, but it just sort of sticks in my mind. Yeah, in the first couple of months that I was a Christian, I bought a poster. And all it was a sunset. Who knows where, you know, even it was taking place, which is a, you know, a pretty sunset poster. But it said in the sky there, you know, it said, "Ah, peace. Thou art such a treasure, I would give everything or anything in the world for thee." But there was a punchline then, wasn't there? And the next line said, "Accept truth. Ah, peace, such a treasure. Give anything in the world for it. Accept truth." So we're pursuing that peace, but also the sanctification, which is created because of faith in the doctrines that God has presented to us. Then it says, though, and there's got to be a tie-in when you have, you know, these verses like this, not disconnected. "See that no one comes short of the grace of God, that no root of bitterness springing up causes trouble, and by it many be defiled." Well, I'm sure that it went with the earlier verses, starting back in verse 11, but it's about this pursuing peace. Brother, when you lack peace with anybody, it's probably a failure on both parts, is likely, but the pursuit hasn't been very capably, you know, executed. And perhaps the failure lies in this root of bitterness. This root of bitterness springing up causes trouble. Now, you may not think so, and it may not even be readily apparent at all. You may not notice it. But when you're hardening your heart against somebody, when you're feeling some sort of disconnect, and, you know, when there's just friction there, when you have peace, perfect peace, then likely there's that little root. Roots are seldom very big and impressive. This root of bitterness springing up, and there's trouble coming. Very seldom, brethren, can you harbor a kind of animosity and then not have it flare up somehow. You're holding back. You're in reservation. You're not freely interacting with this individual. And this root of bitterness then, whatever it is that you think you're cross purposes with these people for, it will cause trouble. It's not just that it is trouble, which it is, but it's going to create more problems. And by it, many be defiled. And I saw a poster just not too long ago I really liked, you know, and it said, "No individual drop thinks that it's responsible for the flood." Have you seen those before? Isn't that just a great thought? No individual drop thinks they're responsible for the flood. But what is this saying? You know, you're participating at even the lowest level. "He that is faithful in much," or "he that is faithful in that which is much," you know, "and he that is faithful in that which is little." We know the rest of those two sentences. "Will be faithful." "He that is faithful in that which is little, though, will be faithful in that which is much. He that is unfaithful in that which is little," what? Well, you're saying is, "I'm unfaithful." You've just decided you're picking and choosing what you're going to be unfaithful about. You deem it to be a small thing. Maybe God doesn't. And all of these are just ways of saying that little things, like the tongue in James 3, have enormous consequences, and many may be defiled by some little, you know, problem that you're harboring in your heart where you're not at peace with who knows who. Psalm 73 is another one that I found is kind of stunning as I was studying for this presentation. Psalm 73, verses 21 and 22. "When my heart was embittered and I was pierced within, then I was senseless and ignorant. I was like a beast before you." That one just fell like a couple of tons on my head. Here's a root of bitterness that causes trouble, and many can be defiled. But when David says, when an embittered heart just exists, you have to accept
that if you're harboring bitterness in your heart, you're senseless and you're ignorant. Whoa! That's a pretty harsh charge, isn't it? Nobody wants to be guilty of that, either one. It is senseless to be bitter. It is ignorant to be bitter. Probably what he's referring to, long before the Hebrew letter will ever be written, is ignorant of the fact that when your heart is embittered, there's a root that can spring up, cause trouble, and defile many. David, Psalm 73, had a son named Abimelech, his firstborn. Abimelech was not at peace with his father, was he? Abimelech would drive his father, David, off his throne, out of his palace, over the Kidron Valley, and into the wilderness in an ill-fated attempt to seize the throne. There was a root of bitterness in there, and it defiled many, those who chose to join his army and attempt his rebellion. And it came to spectacular failure at the loss of life of many, not the least of which is Abimelech himself, and it tore David's heart out. Bitterness is a thing that is not any more noticeable, you know, than the hair of a root that can become gigantic trees. But it's mighty dangerous. And there's a third passage that is just preparatory in understanding how devastating that bitterness can be. And this is James chapter 3, verses 14 through 16. If you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your heart, do not be arrogant and so lie against the truth. This wisdom you're thinking in your heart that produces this jealousy and bitterness, this wisdom is not that which comes down from above, but is earthly, natural, and demonic. For where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, now this has been called a bitter jealousy. You've hardened a heart against somebody. You're thinking about this other individual. You're certainly not at peace with this other individual. We've got a serious problem here. The root's getting pretty big. We're seeing a stalk and branches. He says, now, where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there is disorder and every evil thing. No small problem, no small temptation, no small topic we have on the table for us tonight with regard to this thing that is generally referred to as bitterness, a hardness of heart. Now, you already know the story of Joseph. It's been well over a month ago, but we went through, we looked at all these events, many chapters that are devoted to the man there in the last part of the book of Genesis. He, as a very young teenager, apparently, brought back a bad report on his brothers. He was the favorite son, being the son of his old age. So, you know, Jacob loved him more and made no bones about it to the rest of the boys. He was given, therefore, this coat of many colors. He had a vision of the sheaves, and he had another vision about the sun, the moon, and the stars. Both of those visions were interpreted immediately by his brothers and also by his mom and his dad. Who do you think you are that we would be bowing down to you someday? And so they hardened their hearts. They became bitter against him. This story of Joseph begins with nothing but bitterness, where they might have recognized the bad report was because they had behaved badly. It was their fault, not Joseph's. It's okay for a man who's now had 11 sons to favor one that comes way later than the others from the wife that he paid 7 years, you know, to marry and then got tricked. You know, there's a lot of, you know, history behind this. And when that wife is finally, after all these years of barrenness, able to give birth, you, the older children, really have no call to be upset with Dad, because he's rejoicing with this wife, Rachel, that they've had a son. Now, you can question whether the man, you know, was smart with a coat of many colors, you know, and all that. Maybe he was kind of digging his own pit to fall in. I'll grant you all that. But the sons had really no call. And when God gives somebody a vision, you haven't got a leg to stand on if you're hardening your heart over those things.
But they plotted his murder instead. They sold him into slavery. They lied to Jacob by taking that coat, dipping it in blood, and claiming that he'd been destroyed by a beast. Can you imagine the hardness of heart, the evil that was filling those men's heart? And it all flowed from a tiny little root of jealousy, bitter jealousy. Until Joseph has been torn away, their father's heart has been broken. I'm surprised it didn't kill him, like Eli, just fall off the bench backwards and die. The way this thing creates disorder and every evil thing, didn't it? Just the tiny root. Disorder and every evil thing is present, according to James. Now, I am going to spend just a couple of minutes looking into these three verses from Joseph that I will put on the screen. And then if you want to prepare for it, we'll see a couple of longer passages in Genesis starting at chapter 45. So if you'd like to open Genesis 45, you'll need that in a moment. But these smaller excerpts I've got on the screen here. In Genesis chapter 42, verses 23 and following, Reuben, now that we've been through the famine and they've come and asked for help and they're begging, you know, Joseph himself, you know, for relief in the famine, but they don't recognize Joseph. Joseph knows who they are. They don't know who he is. Reuben answered, he thought privately, to his brothers, saying, "Did I not tell you, do not sin against the boy," against Joseph, not knowing it's the very man they've been talking to. "Now comes the reckoning for his blood. They did not know, however. Joseph understood, for there was an interpreter between them. He turned away from them and wept." Now, I readily admit, it does not assign a reason for that weeping. We have to guess. God wanted us to know, and he left us kind of wondering. But it just broke Joseph's heart. That they were fearing that now, after what they had done, of course he recognizes they think he's long dead. And that's why, "Do not sin against the boy, you would not listen. Now comes the reckoning for his blood." That's a reference that we think he's dead now, by now. Okay? And it breaks his heart. If ever there was a man on this earth who had a right to be angry and sullen and full of grudge and bitterness of every kind, it's Joseph sitting on his throne while the brothers had sold him into slavery and brought on all this hardship, sent him off with fetters and chains, you know, while they're begging for some kind of mercy from him, not knowing who they are. But while we're speculating, and God wants us to know about this, brethren, you can read the rest of the story. He wanted peace with those brothers. I think he sees their fear and it hurts him. I think he sees their sorrow and it hurts him. My own opinion. But my opinion is he recognizes they've been carrying the guilt of this thing for years. And it hurts him. He's not glad about it. If he was a bitter soul, he'd be enjoying it. That is just a pit of depravity. But he isn't. He's weeping when he hears this. That suggests to me that he has got to love these brothers. He has got to be caring for them in this moment. He is going to put them through a ringer, I admit. If you've read the story, you know how he kind of works them over, and you know, silver and money in our bags and all that. Okay, so he made them work for it in a way, but there were reasons and purposes for this. He loves them, and he has to turn away and weep. He has to hide it. Again, in the next chapter, he is still doing this negotiating. They still don't know who he is. Chapter 43, verses 29 and 30, he lifted his eyes and saw his brother Benjamin. So they've gone home like he asked them, like Joseph asked, brought the brother back, brother he's never seen, his little brother, last of the 12 tribes. "Is this your youngest brother of whom he spoke to me?" He said, "May God be gracious to you, my son." Joseph hurried out, for he was deeply stirred over his brother. He sought a place to weep, and he entered his chamber and wept there. Now again, in this occasion, it's very clear what's happening here. He'd never seen the brother. He called for them to go get the brother. He's meeting his brother for the first time, his little brother, and he's overcome with all the emotions you'd expect in finally getting to meet a brother born after all of this heartache and all of this trouble. But brethren, again, here's temptation. Can't you hear Satan whispering? That when he's feeling all of this emotion and he's just, you know, weeping and just overwhelmed by it all, can't you see how Satan would tempt him then to think, and it's those other brothers' fault. It's you and me, Benjamin, against these others. You and me. We've been kept apart. We were innocent. We did the right thing. We didn't call any of this down on our heads. We didn't deserve this. So all this emotion and upset, you know, is in recognition of years deprived of them. It'd be so easy to turn and point that finger at those other boys. But he doesn't seem to be doing this. Now we come to the two passages I want you to look at. The Genesis, the 45th chapter, we're going to read the first 9 verses here. So pretty lengthy passage. But Joseph could not control himself before all those who stood by him, and he cried, "Have everyone go out from me." So there was no man with him when Joseph made himself known to his brothers. And he wept so loudly that the Egyptians heard it. The household of Pharaoh heard it. And then Joseph said to his brothers, "I am Joseph. Is my father still alive?" But his brothers could not answer him. They were dismayed at his presence. Can you imagine? Here's this number two in command in all of Egypt. We don't know this guy. We've never met this guy. What's the deal here? He's out of his mind. And madmen kill all the time when they've got power like this. What in the world, you know, is this about? Now he's claiming to be a relative. The guy's out of his mind. You know, what next? So he's weeping. That's always impressive. Claims he's Joseph. Asked about his father. And scares the brothers to death. Then Joseph, in verse 4, said to his brothers, "Please come closer to me." They came closer, and he said, "I'm your brother Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. And now, do not be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. For God sent me before you to preserve life. The famine has been in the land these 2 years. There are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting. And God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant in the earth, to keep you alive by a great deliverance. Now, therefore, it was not you who sent me here, but God. And he has made me a father to Pharaoh, and lord of all his household, and ruler over all the land of Egypt. Hurry, go up to my father, say to him, 'Thus says your son Joseph, God,'" third time he's invoked, "God, has made me lord of all Egypt. Come down to me and do not delay." Brethren, lesser men and women could have cut off those brothers' heads in an instant. Lesser men and women would bear a grudge, lash out, get that pound of flesh. Lesser people succumb to the root of bitterness. Lesser people allow every kind of evil loose on the earth because they don't pursue the peace. They pursue the crime. They wallow in that. They think about that. It's hard for all of us, brethren. I've struggled with this. You've struggled with this. You've had somebody do you wrong. You can't live without it. It happens to everybody. You know how that root can worm its way down into your heart. And here rises up Joseph. "I get it. God, 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 in ways none of us could have imagined, God was using you. It was part of a plan. I know there's 5 more years coming because I got further visions when I was in Egypt. It all makes sense. And what have the brothers been doing before him? Just like the sheaves, the sun, the moon, and the stars bowing down before him in all sorts of consternation, And finally, here he is, the long-lost brother, whose blood guiltiness we've been carrying all this time. So, it's a wondrous moment. And Joseph is this towering figure in world history who will not allow that root of bitterness so much as a molecule's worth of space in his heart. Look at verses 14 and 15 in the same chapter 45. Then he fell on his brother Benjamin's neck and wept. Benjamin wept on his neck. He kissed all his brothers and wept on them. And afterward, his brothers talked with him. Well, not only was Joseph's time with his brother, little brother, unknown brother, Benjamin, stolen from him, but for every minute, you know, of that length of time, whose relationship and interaction was also stolen from him? The rest of his brothers. And so here we are. I got to add this thing up, you know, 10 of them, you know, and these last two. We've all been deprived of those interactions. And instead of being mad about it, he just rejoices to start over again. We'll close the lesson this evening with these verses in chapter 50. This is how Genesis draws to an end. It's the last chapter in the book of Genesis. In Genesis 50, and beginning in verse 15, when Joseph's brother saw, that their father, Jacob, had died, they said, "What if Joseph should bear a grudge against us?" They know a bit about the root of bitterness, it sounds like, doesn't it? "What if Joseph should bear a grudge against us and pay us back in full for all the wrong which we did to him?" Now, they've learned enough in these first, we just read the verses, about Joseph to recognize he doesn't want to cause his father any grief. He doesn't want, you know, to upset the anciently aged father now. But the father's gone. Now he'll strike. Now he'll pay back. Now he'll do what we did to him. Now will come the anger pouring forth. Now he'll be a regular man. But he wasn't, was he? He wasn't at all. He's a superior human being. So we see in verse 16, they sent a message to Joseph saying, "Your father charged before he died, saying..." Now, brethren, this is apparently an outright lie. I mean, it looks like it's just a lie. "Thus you shall say to Joseph, 'Please forgive, I beg you, the transgression of your brothers and their sin, for they did you wrong.'" And you claim he said, "And now, please forgive the transgression of the servants of the God of your father." They add themselves. "And Joseph wept when they spoke to him. Then his brothers also came and fell down before him and said, 'Behold, we are your servants.' But Joseph said to them, 'Do not be afraid, for am I in God's place? And as for you, you meant evil against me.'" Joseph is not stupid. He is also not forgetful. The way he has behaved is in the full knowledge of everything that went down. He hasn't forgotten any of it. So he says, "As for you, you meant evil against me. But God meant it for good, in order to bring about this present result, to preserve many people alive. So therefore, do not be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones." So he comforted them, spoke kindly to them. Now Joseph stayed in Egypt, he and his father's household. Joseph lived 110 years. Joseph saw the third generation of Ephraim's sons. Also the sons of Machir, the sons of Manasseh, were born on Joseph's knees. Joseph said to his brothers, "I'm about to die, but God will surely take care of you, bring you up from this land to the land which he promised an oath to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob." Joseph made the sons of Israel swear, saying, "God will surely take care of you, and you shall carry my bones up from here." So Joseph died at the age of 110 years, was embalmed and placed in a coffin in Egypt. Here's the part that Moses should have written but didn't. "With an absolutely pure heart, no bitterness or grudge toward anybody about anything." That's how he died in Egypt. Free. having pursued peace till he had captured it and held it so it could not escape. No root of bitterness in that man's heart. Now, if he can do it against those kind of odds, can you? Sure. Okay? Next time somebody steps on your toes, think about David. Joseph. They're stepping on your toes. He's looking up from the bottom of the pit at the strangers' faces that he's just been sold to. If he can do it, we can do it. And if I or the elders or anyone else can help with some struggle, prayer request, with Bible study of some kind, then as always we offer you this opportunity. Let it be known, or call us later, or send us a text. Be happy to help any way that we can. But let's stand together.